may be seated. Our next case, 10-2148, Sandra Hovell versus Villa St. Joseph et al. For the appellant, Ms. Heim.
Thank you, Your Honor. Chief Justice O'Connor, and may it please the court, Laura Heim for the state of Ohio. I'd like to reserve 2 minutes for rebuttal, which appellant's counsel Brett Perry will present. The issue in this case is whether a civil defendant's right to bifurcation is substantive or procedural. It's substantive. It builds on the constitutional right to be free from excessive damages by ensuring that the jury does not assess liability and determine compensatory damages based on its desire to punish.
Would you speak into the microphone? I'm having trouble hearing you when you turn your head.
It's building on the defendant's constitutional right to be free from excessive damages by ensuring that the jury does not assess liability and determine compensatory damages based on its desire to punish the defendant. So even though this right comes packaged in procedural wrapping, it is a substantive right that the General Assembly had authority to confer. Protecting civil defendants from unjust damages awards lies at the very core of substantive law. The Constitution, as both this court and the U.S. Supreme Court has recognized, gives special due process protections to civil defendants subject to punitive damages awards. And that's based in part in the fact that punitive damages are the closest thing the civil system can come to imposing a criminal punishment on a particular defendant. And so with that greater threat to liberty necessarily comes greater due process protection.
Well, now that you call it liberty, punitive damage is only a apply when the conduct has been reprehensible. And so that's the conduct for which you wrap this in a liberty?
In the due process protections of liberty and property, and to ensure that that's not denied in an arbitrary or capricious manner.
Our court and the U.S. Supreme Court have both said there are limits on what can be imposed in terms of punitives.
Of course, Your Honor, and that's why this court has given special due process protections for punitive damages, to assure that they are imposed when appropriate, but they are not imposed in an arbitrary and capricious manner.
I'm wondering, and this is what I'm scratching my head about in reading the statute, how's this going to work, the bifurcation? If the jury comes back and says, yes, there are compensatory, and there has it's punitives have been pled and they haven't been knocked out up to that point, so they're still alive in the case. Once the jury comes back, does the judge say, okay, tomorrow morning be back in the courthouse and we'll begin the punitive damage part of the case?
That's my understanding of how it would work. I think a useful analogy for exactly the roadmap for how this goes would be to the capital punishment context, where the jury determines guilt or innocence, and then the judge sets a separate date for a separate
hearing. So is the state stipulating that it would be the same jury?
Your Honor, the state takes no position on that, but I assume that that is typically how things operate.
Well, this is new, so there isn't any how things operate typically.
Respectfully, Justice Pfeiffer, it's not entirely new, because the civil rule, and that's partially why we're here, the civil rule already provides a way for
there to be
bifurcation.
When I read the civil rule, that contemplates two juries.
I'm sorry, Justice Pfeiffer, I'm not prepared to speak on that, because that's just not something that we have looked into.
You're talking about a very small niche here. The statute, pretty short. The rule's pretty short. And I have a hard time reading the rule and concluding that it doesn't contemplate two juries.
My understanding of the rule, Justice Pfeiffer, is that it's really very wide open. It gives the trial court discretion to bifurcate, says some things the trial court may consider in the process of doing so, but doesn't speak specifically to the issue of the jury. But I'm not really sure this court needs to consider exactly how that would all play out, because we're here on a very narrow issue of law today, and that's whether
It has a big impact on the operation of our courts and the taking up of court time. If you've got to start this case all over, bring the same experts back, try the case twice, I don't think, I doubt that you're here to advocate that, are you?
Your Honor, I'm here to advocate the upholding of the statute, which does give a right to bifurcation upon the defendant's request. If I could address your question sort of in two parts, the first being to this logistical matter. As for the presentation of evidence, the statute specifically says that evidence solely relating to punitive damages can't come in at the compensatory phase. And so what we would be reserving...
What would be an example of that?
Evidence, perhaps, of the defendant's deep pockets, that they make this much money a year and are therefore have the ability to pay excessive damages, or perhaps evidence of the defendant's malice or wrongdoing. That's something that doesn't really inform the assessment of whether the plaintiff was injured or not, of whether the plaintiff deserves compensation.
Their wrongdoing is an integral part of the case in chief, is it not?
Of course, and I think that might suggest that there would be, there wouldn't be the same kind of expediency concerns that perhaps you're worried about, because the evidence of wrongdoing that goes to the elements of the cause of action is going to come in the compensatory phase.
Right.
It's solely in that separate phase where we'll start talking about malice or ill will or the egregiousness of the conduct. So really, I don't think expediency is as much of a problem as perhaps it may seem.
Only if you have to have two juries.
Your Honor, again, I think this would be very much like a capital trial plays out and that there wouldn't be two juries. I don't see anything in the statute or the rule
We've already had the ability to have the bifurcation in a situation like this. It could have been discretionary with the judge, and there are common pleas cases that have already done this and have bifurcated and used the same jury just to present the additional evidence if there was, in fact, a finding of malice. Is that correct?
Yes, Your Honor. Bifurcation is a power that has been in the hands of the trial judges since this court enacted Rule 42B. But what the General Assembly sought to do by enacting Senate Bill 80, by conferring this right to bifurcation, is to ensure that if the defendant wants bifurcation, believes that it is necessary, the defendant gets it. And because that's something that's, on its face, it sounds superficially procedural because it is telling trial judges what they have to do when the defendant tries to invoke this right. But underneath that layer of procedural wrapping is this substantive right to be free from the jury making inappropriate considerations at the liability phase and then again at the punitive damages phase. And so because the statute protects that underlying substantive right, and because, as the General Assembly recognized in its uncodified language, there is a very real risk here to...
Counsel, there's no judicial discretion if a motion is made under 2115.21b, is that correct?
That is correct. If any party requests bifurcation, then bifurcation has to occur under the statute.
Okay, and if the compensatory and punitives are pled, correct?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay, can you envision any time when the defendant would want the punitives and the compensatory in the same case?
I suppose it's possible if it was a particularly sympathetic defendant and they had a great case to plead for how even if you gave punitive damages, we wouldn't be able to pay, something like that, maybe the defendant would want compensatory and punitives in at the same time. But the fact that the defendants probably would typically plead this, I think just goes to the fact that this is a substantive law that the General Assembly had authority to confer. It is a right, and civil defendants see it as a very important right to keep the jury from imposing punitively tainted compensatory damages.
Well, as the statute seems to make it mandatory, and the rule makes it discretionary, and the trial judge can determine what he or she feels appropriate as to whether it should or shouldn't come in, what does your research show as to courts around Ohio at the appellate level who have ruled on this?
Your Honor, there is the Hanners case, which is the conflict case, and then other cases out of the 8th District which have ruled specifically on this issue. The state has taken the position that there is a conflict between the rule and the statute. Mr. Perry and the appellants have a little bit of a different take on that, that because the statute only applies to tort actions, there won't necessarily always be a conflict. I'm sure that he would be able to address that particular question during his time on rebuttal.
Well, counsel, if the rule requires separate juries and the statute simply requires the same jury but in two phases, that doesn't conflict, does it? That's more of a supplementation.
The state is of the position that there is a conflict, because when it is a tort action that is to be tried to a jury where there's compensatory and punitive damages pled, that is going to run against Rule 42B. But again, going back to the separate jury, I'm just not sure that either the statute or the rule suggests anything. I believe the rule gives the trial court perhaps discretion to use separate juries, but I don't see anything in there that mandates it.
Well, counsel, the statute, or the rule says, this is what I was referring to. The court, after a hearing in furtherance of convenience or to avoid prejudice, or when separate trials will be conducive. Now, am I wrong to think that separate trials mean separate trials, not two parts of the same trial?
Justice Piper, that's something that I suppose we could debate. I don't know the case law on that issue, and it's not something I researched, in part because I don't think it's particularly relevant to the issue of whether this is a substantive law or a procedural law. The state has accepted Ms. Havel's position that there is a conflict here, and so what this court then needs to do is conduct the analysis to determine whether this is substantive or procedural. And for that analysis, I think the best case, the most helpful case, is Lloyd versus Lovelady. There was a statute that's on its face looked superficially procedural. It gave people subject to child support orders a way to challenge those orders, to reopen the proceedings, notwithstanding anything that Rule 60B said. So on its face, we had something that was superficially procedural. The court looked at that, but then looked one layer underneath, to use the court's word, and unwrapped the procedural wrapping, and found a substantive right that the General Assembly was trying to protect, and that was the right to prevent being subject to unjust judgments. That same right
so
is
counsel,
at stake
what,
here.
So, counsel, what basically do you want us to do here? What should we write?
The state requests that you recognize that even though this is a statute wrapped in procedural wrapping, that underneath there is a substantive right that the General Assembly was trying to protect. That is the substantive right to be free from punitively tainted compensatory damages awards, the substantive right to have liability be assessed really on the basis of whether the defendant is liable and not on the basis of any of their deep pockets or of any ill will that there might be evidence of at the punitive phase.
But what about the authority of this court and the Modern Courts Amendment? We are a separate and equal branch of government, and the court is to set procedures for the trial courts.
Of course, Your Honor. As this court recognized in Krauss versus State, though, substance and procedure aren't always mutually exclusive. And so I think the best way to look at it is to place procedure and substance on a spectrum. And what this court is trying to do is determine whether something is substantive enough to fall within the policymaking powers of the General Assembly. Now, it's true that there are some procedural rules, say a procedural rule, if the General Assembly tried to legislate how many days somebody had to appeal to this court. Now, there may be way underneath there some sort of substantive right that's trying to be protected, but I think this court could say that that's too attenuated to be a substantive right that the legislature has authority to protect, and something that only this court can rule on.
I asked the question a different way. I think your argument is that a person has a right to a trial and liability and compensatory damages free from evidence that would apply to punitive damages, that being a substantive right. Is evidence the admission or exclusion of evidence a procedural or a substantive right?
In many cases, Justice Kupp, and sort of the ringside determinations of whether something comes in or something stays out, that's a procedural rule. But the General Assembly has, on repeated occasions, legislated in the area of admissibility of evidence when it comes down to something that is necessary to protect a substantive right. I think a great example of that is the Rape Shield Statute, which says under what circumstances evidence of a victim's prior sexual conduct can come in, and that is that it's to protect the substantive rights of the defendant to adequately present evidence. It's also to protect the substantive rights of the victim. And so even though in many cases evidentiary type rulings do fall within the sole authority of this court to draft the rules of evidence, of the trial court to enforce, there are overriding substantive goals that the General Assembly can step in to legislate as a matter of public policy. I see that my time is short. If I could reserve the balance for Mr. Perry.
Thank you. Mr. Dixon.
Chief Justice O'Connor, members of the court, may it please the court, my name is Blake Dixon. I represent Sandra Hovell, who is the personal representative of the estate of John Hovell, and I can actually answer your questions about how this works in trial, because I'm actually in trial right now, hoping to give closing arguments tomorrow in Mansfield in Richland County, and the trial is bifurcated, and there is no punitive damage phase even scheduled at this point. So the way this has worked is we have a compensatory trial. Assuming I get a verdict this week, then the judge is going to schedule a whole new trial with a whole new jury to consider the issue of punitive damages. And I'm going to have to bring all my witnesses back. I'm going to have to
resubmit. Where in the statute does it say you have to have a separate jury?
The statute actually talks about two phases. The civil rule talks about two trials, as Justice Pfeiffer pointed out.
So he's reading them together, is that?
He's reading them together. I mean, the dilemma for the practitioner currently is, as in this case, I don't oppose motions for bifurcation because I don't want to endure the appeal. You know, the Hovell case has been on hold for 2 years, and the case that I'm trying now would never have gotten to trial now if I'd opposed bifurcation, because if I win, we go up on appeal. And one of the things we discussed with the 8th District was, you know, is there any way that this doesn't have to be appealed? Can we have a ruling so that there isn't an appeal built into every one of these cases? I'm actually more concerned with the delay than I am with the procedure.
Well, so as a practitioner, it would be more advantageous if there's going to be a bifurcation that you have a civil phase and then you continue with the same jury and have the punitive phase and get it all over with.
So in contrast to the trial I'm in now, on October 3rd, I try another trial, start another jury trial in Jefferson County. Justice Brazies has scheduled 2 weeks of compensatory. He would then have gone directly into punitives. As it turns out, the court is unavailable that week, but he is going to keep the same jury impaneled, and we're going to move to the punitive phase of the trial immediately after that with the same jury. So that's the alternate to that. Certainly the worst case scenario.
Is that under the civil rule you're doing that one in Jefferson, or is that under the statute?
And again, so the motion is always made for bifurcation under the statute, and in that case, as in this case, as in the case I'm in now, I didn't oppose it. So I assume, since there's two phases of the single trial, he did grant it under the statute. To answer another question, you asked a question about if the punitives are not knocked out. One of the things I want to make clear to the court in case it makes it into your ruling is, since there's no evidence that goes to punitives during the compensatory damage phase of the trial, there should be no determination, yes or no, for punitives during that phase of the trial. If you are awarded compensatory...
But there will be inevitably some information as you're seeking compensatory damages that reflect and will be put forth if you make it to a punitive phase. I mean, just what happened is going to be a trigger for punitives when the narrative is told through the witnesses, of course, what happened to the victim. Am I correct?
You're 100% correct. And that's one of the reasons that the trial court should have discretion, because sometimes there's no evidence that's just punitive. Let me give you two examples. Let's assume we have two drunk driving cases. And in case number one, there's a single incidence of drunk driving. In case number two, there's an incidence of drunk driving, but the guy has 10 prior DUIs. In the first case, there's no reason for bifurcation because the fact that he was drunk at the time of the collision is going to come in, and that's sufficient to justify punitive damages. In the second case, there is a justification for bifurcation because the 10 DUIs would probably improperly influence the jury. So that's why the trial judges need to have discretion. Under the statute, the first case has to be bifurcated, and the victim of drunk driving has to try the case twice, even though, as you just said, there's really no evidence that isn't going to already be in that first phase of the trial.
Do you agree in your example that the one with 10 prior convictions should be a separate proceeding, or do you think it should be in one proceeding?
My preference would be that there's a very good argument for bifurcation. My preference as a practitioner and a plaintiff's lawyer would be one jury, two phases. So you conclude the first phase, the jury finds in favor of the plaintiff, awards damages, and then you move to the second phase where they hear additional evidence and they make a determination of punitives.
So if we agree with your presentation and your view that in some instances it might be appropriate to have one jury proceeding where evidence may come in, but the judge can control it through discretion. But in other instances, there ought to be two proceedings, How do we write a rule here in this case that will help not that situation, but help every situation in Ohio so that trial judges will know what they should do when they get these kinds of issues?
I would respectfully submit that you've already written that rule, and it's Civil Rule 42B. I mean, I think you've given the trial judge discretion to, and I think they're the best, you know, they're the best people to be involved. I mean, I appeared in front of you when you were on the common police court in Cuyahoga County.
And you did well.
Thank you very much. You know,
that long ago, huh?
You're there listening to the case, and it should be a case-by-case basis. That's, you know, all the concerns expressed by the appellants can be addressed in every case, because don't forget, if you uphold the 8th District's ruling, there can still be bifurcation of every trial in Ohio for the end of time. But it's just that the trial judge gets to decide. It's just that you don't have to have bifurcation.
And what is the standard if the trial judge decides wrongly? Is there an abuse of discretion standard in which appellate court has to look at the eventual evidence that comes in and says, whoa, that was really prejudicial in terms of separating compensatory from punitives? Judge, you shouldn't have done that, so we're going to reverse it, and you're going to have to try it in separate phases.
That's a good question, and I don't know if it would be an abuse of discretion standard or a de novo standard, but clearly, if the defendants could make an argument that there should have been bifurcation, and that because there wasn't bifurcation, you know, the jury's verdict was based on passion and prejudice, the jury was improperly influenced, the jury considered improper consideration, just like any time evidence is admitted that shouldn't be admitted. Let's say you have an auto case and somebody says, you know, by the way, ladies and gentlemen of the jury, there's a $10 million insurance policy. You know, what's the remedy there? Either there's a mistrial or there's not, and if it's influential, you go to the Court of Appeals and say, this is why this verdict came, because of this improper evidence. So I think that's a good question. I don't know that that's been tested. I'm not aware of a situation where a trial court's decision to bifurcate a trial has then been challenged in the appellate court. My research didn't reveal any, but I think that would be the remedy.
Counsel, if we were to distinguish between the rule discretionary state for many different types of trials versus this one that requires the bifurcation, but make it clear to trial judges that it should be with the same jury, could you conduct it similar to a death penalty where you simply move to admit evidence you've already admitted in the first part, in the second part since they've already heard it, and then just do the additional?
That would absolutely be my hope, Your Honor. You know, there are challenges, there are challenges with voir dire. I think that during voir dire, you're not going to get to talk about punitives, and I think it's clear that you couldn't tell the jury that a punitive damage phase was coming, because that's kind of the whole point. But I, you know, if it, you know, my preference would always be that it'd be one jury, one proceeding, because, you know, the defendants have concerns about improper influence. The plaintiffs have concerns about, you know, unbearable burden in a case. It's already hard enough to try a case and spend the money on experts and subpoena witnesses. To then make you do that twice is a very difficult decision. Just so, Connor, if I could just get back to one thing you asked me, I do want to make it clear that that even though some evidence that's relevant to punitives does go in the compensatory phase, because you're not allowed to make your argument for punitives, there is no interim determination by the court, punitives, yes or no. The case law is clear that if you are awarded compensatory damages, you're then entitled to a punitive phase of the trial. And then that's where that decision is made. And if the court can then say, the jury can then say, you haven't met your burden. This was negligence. It wasn't actual malice. It wasn't reckless. We're not awarding punitives.
Is there a concern on your part? You're talking from the plaintiff's attorney's point of view. If you get less than unanimous on the first go-around for compensatory, are you worried about the holdouts or the people who voted poisoning the well when it comes to punitives?
You know, that's already a problem, Your Honor, because as you know, the jurors that don't vote for liability still get to decide, you know, the amount of damages. And so if you've got six jurors that think the defendant's liable and two that don't, so they move on to then damages, the two that didn't think the defendant was liable in the first place can certainly try to drag down the amount of the award. And so that's an inherent problem in the system. And I think that it's a problem that's going to consist, because if you're going to start eliminating people, we're not going to have enough for a majority by the time we get to punitives. You know, if you eliminate two in the first part, then you have six left, and then if two of those don't agree, so.
Counsel, The state has made the argument of the due process rights of the defendant. It would seem to me there are some, if we want to hang this all on due process, we should be thinking about the person, your client in this case, and their due process rights. It would seem to me, if it's bifurcated and there are two trials, the end result of that would be you and other lawyers, we counsel many plaintiffs, let's forget about, we think we have a case for punitives, but let's forget about it. It's going to be too expensive, too cumbersome, too this or too that. Then coming to your case here, it's bed sores. We don't know much about the case because we have a constitutional argument here. It strikes me on its surface that that's sort of an unusual case to even have punitives in. But I assume you also have a client who was aged, and so compensatories are going to be low. So is that part of the strategy mix when you decide to go for plaintiffs? Because you've got somebody old, loss of income, all of those things. The compensatories are necessarily going to be very low, but you think you've got really bad conduct on the part of the nursing home, so you put in punitives.
So
and so that's an overlay. That's a long question, but does that relate back then to the due process rights of the plaintiff being affected by this statute?
You know, if the plaintiff has a right, and just so the court can think about it in this context, in this case, unlike pretty much any other case, we're talking about a statutory claim. You're talking about the Nursing Home Bill of Rights, and the plaintiff in this case has a statutory right to bring a claim for the violation of those rights. And as this court and I discussed in the Hayes case, there are rights guaranteed by that Bill of Rights that have to be upheld. So are we now putting unbearable hurdles in front of those rights? And you're absolutely right. In this case, Your Honor, I have 20 binders of medical records. I have two separate defendants, one of whom allowed this man to develop horrific bed sores, and the other whom neglected him to the point where he died. And so I already have multiple experts, multiple challenges. When I hire an expert, I got to send them all these records and pay for their time to review them. So the cost of the case and the burden to the case is already huge. Now, if I have to try the case twice, fly my experts in twice, subpoena all the witnesses twice, the burden is almost doubled. And so if it is one jury, two phases, that does address that concern, which goes back to why I think the judge should have discretion. If it is two totally separate trials, two different voir dires, a lot more time. You know, it's a big burden on the trial courts. It's a big burden on them to have two trials. I mean, it's hard for me as a guy who most of my trials are 2 to 3 weeks to get a trial judge to block that time. And, you know, they're obviously more likely to do a one-day criminal trial than to be tied up for 3 weeks when they have lots of stuff
to
do.
So our question really gets back to the constitutionality of the statute, and that was the conflict that was presented to us in this case. You answered earlier that you thought that our rule vested the trial court with discretion, and we've already written what we need to write. Do we declare the statute then to be unconstitutional, as in conflict with the Modern Courts Amendment? Is that the declaration you want out of this case?
I think every time this statute is enacted, it conflicts with the civil rule, because
it's only been enacted once, as far as I know.
I apologize. Every time it's put into practice, every time it's upheld by any court, it's in conflict. Because
what about the argument that Ms. Heim makes that there is a substantive right inherent in this statute that a defendant, and you admitted in one of your examples, had a right to just simply prosecute the case without all of the punitive evidence coming in for a determination on liability, and then if that were the case, then evidence of malice or other activity would be properly admissible. What about that substantive right argument that was made?
Well, two things. Number one, in the malice case, you know, don't forget that one of the definitions of actual malice is a conscious disregard for the rights and safety of others, such that significant harm is substantially certain to occur. That comes in the compensatory phase, because that is the conduct that led to the harm. And just because you have a negligence standard doesn't mean you can't show harm that's beyond, you can't show conduct that's worse than that standard. So as Justice O'Connor pointed out, that is intertwined, and that's never going to be unbundled. So is there, does the defendant have a right, you know, not for the jury to hear about their misconduct? Not if it goes to proximate cause, not if it goes to negligence, not if it caused the harm. Do they have a due process right against excessive awards? You know, it's kind of funny, in the papers, it was a due process right to avoid excessive punitive awards. Then my amicus made the point that this statute has nothing to do with the amount of the punitive award, it has to do with the amount of the compensatory award. Because this statute doesn't prevent the jury from hearing anything relative to the punitive award. By the time we get there, it's all on the table. So this statute really only has to do with the amount of the compensatories. So this morning, the argument was, we have a due process right not to have excessive compensatory awards. I kind of always thought that having a trial judge and eight jurors was how we, you know, upheld those rights. I think having a jury trial and having the right to have a lawyer and make the argument for you is how you get due process so you don't have an excessive compensatory award.
But Mr. Dixon, isn't it, I mean, when you look at the statute and we talk about what the jury is not to hear,
yes,
if the statute applies,
yes,
evidence that relates solely to whether there should be punitive damages.
Yes.
And your point is well taken about the malice and so on that relates to the actions of the defendant would be in the case no matter what. Aren't we just talking about how much a defendant can afford to pay? I mean, that's what the statute is intending to keep from the jury. How much can the defendant afford to pay if, you know, if he's really a bad actor or she's a bad actor? So it's a situation that is more limited than maybe we're talking about here. And my other question is, what are we talking solely about your wish to declare B unconstitutional? Because 23-15-21, the punitive damage statute, is rather involved. And what I think we're talking about is B, which you're arguing is the procedural section that conflicts with the current Rule 42, correct?
If I had any hope to convince this body to throw out the entire statute, I would certainly do that. Despite the fact that I think of myself as a pretty good lawyer, I don't think that I can convince you to do that. So, yes, my limited goal here today is that the bifurcation statute conflicts with the civil rule. That's exactly what we're talking about. I agree with you 100%. You know, I think that, for example, if there's a case where there should be bifurcation, you're absolutely right. Why is it relevant to say, and by the way, the person that caused this harm is worth $100 million? That shouldn't be why they base their decision. But ask yourself this question. What if we have a stipulated liability case? In many, many, many of my nursing home cases, when push comes to shove, they admit liability, and we go to trial on damages. So they've admitted wrongdoing. So there's no improper determination of wrongdoing. So now we're just going to damages. Well, why should that case have to be bifurcated in every single circumstance? Stipulated liability cases have to be bifurcated under the statute. They could admit liability and proximate cause and say we're just going to go on damages. And it would still have to be bifurcated and there would still be this burden. And I think that every one of their concerns can be properly addressed by the trial judges. And the trial judges can hear those concerns and say, you're right. In this case, there should be bifurcation. The jury shouldn't hear all that stuff. You're 100% right. But it shouldn't be mandated in every case, which is why the Supreme Court gets to decide procedure and how the courts are run.
And what you're saying is that 42 right now as it stands, as this court has already determined, can actually fulfill the statute's purpose, because the discretion is built in there to take care of what you're talking about.
100%. I do think it would be helpful to say that this court does not read 42 to prohibit a single jury trial in two phases, because the language, as Justice Pfeiffer pointed out, does say the word two trials. And so I think it would be helpful to say, you know, we didn't mean that to mean it has to be two different juries and two different, you know, whole proceedings. That would be helpful. But I think beyond that, absolutely, there isn't, as I read these briefs, there's not one thing they're concerned about that they can't argue to the trial judge. And the trial judge, as the two trial judges I have in my next two trials, said, you're 100% right. We're going to bifurcate. They're not going to hear about this big corporation and their deep pockets or any of those things. That'll be phase two. And that's what we do.
Thank you.
Thank you.
All right, Mr. Perry. You have 33 seconds. We'll give you a little more, though.
May it please the court. My name is Brett Perry, and I proudly represent the village at Marymount and Villa St. Edward. I'd like to just touch on a few points that the court has asked about. And I think Justice O'Donnell was attempting to ask, how is this playing out in the trial court? You know, are they being bifurcated? Unlike Mr. Dixon, who didn't oppose the bifurcation in this case, there's a feverish opposition to bifurcation. And if they're and the reason for that feverish opposition is because the litigants want to bring in evidence of wrongdoing, malice, punitive evidence to overinflate the compensatory phase or to harm the compensatory phase of the litigation.
And how were the judges ruling on that?
And they were denying those motions to bifurcate, thus prompting the enactment of this statute. There was a need to protect this substantive right. If the courts were exercising their discretion correctly, and they were exercising it to protect both litigants, to ensure that we're talking about compensatory phase versus punitive phase, the statute clearly wouldn't have been a necessity to be enacted. The legislature saw a clear intent to protect a substantive right here.
Did you say the judges are denying bifurcation?
On rare occasions, are we ever having a bifurcation motion granted? And the issue before it, as Judge Pfeiffer brought up, how do we handle this?
It's going to take before the statute. You said that they are.
Before Hanners was argued, Your Honor, there was no final appealable order for the denial of a substitute.
If I understood the Chief Justice's question, it is how are judges handling this now with the statute that says there should be.
Since this court accepted jurisdiction, most of it's been stayed, and they're going to issue the ruling after this court issues its ruling. But it's a conflict. Many of the trial judges come back to, how do we handle this? Do I bring these juries down? How do we set it forth? The statute's very clear. It's not two separate trials. It's two different phases,
Counsel,
two different stages.
It's been argued to us that there's an absolute due process right to have bifurcation of punitives in every case.
Your Honor, the statute speaks only to tort actions. It's
right.
A limited
but in every,
circumstance.
Every tort case, there's a due process right. Is there any U.S. Supreme Court case that says that there's a due process right to have a separate trial on punitives in every tort case?
There's no Supreme Court case speaking to the issue of whether bifurcation is a substantive right, but the issue—
I'm not asking you. I'm asking you, is there a U.S. Supreme Court case? Because they've had punitives there several times with many of the people who populate the court. I mean, Scalia says we shouldn't even be looking at this. This is a state question and not a federal question.
No,
but they've taken a number of punitive damage cases. Have they ever said there's a due process right to have bifurcation of punitive damages in tort cases?
Not to my knowledge, Your Honor. The answer is not to my knowledge on that issue.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you very much, counsel. We will take the matter under advisement, and you will receive our opinion.
Thank you, Your Honor.